The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 26th of June 2020. I'm here in Tanunda in the home of Patsy Bisco. Patsy, firstly, thank you for agreeing to talk with me this morning and to participate in the RSL, A Time to Celebrate. Can I just ask you, please, could you just state your full name, date of birth, and service number if you have it handy there?
Don't have the service number, as we've just discussed, but I do know that Tanunda RSL will give you that. Great pleasure to be here also. And Patsy Bisco is my name, and I was born in, who can ever believe it, after all these years, in March, 21st of March 1946. Such a long time ago, which brings us to the years I'll be talking about in Vietnam, 50 years ago virtually, half a century. Absolutely extraordinary to think back that far.
Isn't it?
I know you've interviewed people through the course of all of this who've perhaps are talking about it much further, you know, much longer ago. But 50 years since everybody talked about Vietnam, everybody felt so much for the guys who were going over there, and slightly over 50 years when I was approached while I was working at Channel 9 on Here's Humphrey, the children's program, asked if I would go with a Tasmanian entertainment troupe to Vietnam, obviously South Vietnam. And I was delighted. There's a little frisson of fear in there because it was an unknown, and I had never been overseas. I'd been working very hard on television, stage, recordings and so on, and just never occurred to me to take any time off. It wasn't that sort of job, if I could put it that way. So I was excited, I was a little bit apprehensive, and it sounded so exotic. Vietnam, back in the early 70s. So in 1971, I became an Australian citizen because I was British. My parents were stationed in India, where I was born. Then we came to Australia, but I just always considered myself Australian. I was tiny when I came here. But of course, to go into a war zone, I had to become an Australian citizen. So that was the first of the huge moments to do with this mere 17 days, because they had to get us in and out in something like 17 days. So there were no ramifications, I gather anyway, to do with pensions or, you know, anything like that. So it was, because you weren't in the forces as such. My first memory is there were two things, and one reflects the times that were so much more innocent and so much more ordered than the times now. A producer from the ABC Radio in Hobart met me, because I did my primary school in Sydney and then my high school and university in Hobart, and then came to Adelaide because that's where the children's music was and so on. So he met me when I flew to Sydney, which in itself was a huge trip in those days. And Jack Smith, his name was, he's long dead now, splendid man. And he wanted to take me to a hotel, a very ritzy hotel in Sydney for lunch before he waved me farewell when he put me on the plane, and off he went back to Hobart, and I went then to Saigon. And because he didn't have a tie on, he was not allowed in. Absolutely extraordinary times. It sort of sets the scene for my first memory of the actual trip. It was a dedicated, probably ANZAC flight back then, only very young soldiers who'd been enlisted, and our little Tasmanian party troop, which was we three girls sang. There was an MC, so-called, a compere, and a wonderful trad jazz band called the Sullivan's Cove Jazz Stompers. Fabulous, great band. And we got on this plane, that was great. But the being refused because you didn't have a tie on, and the times were reflected in the sort of young boys who were on this plane, and they were boys. I don't recall any women at all or girls, and they'd been enlisted, and they were excited. They were so excited about this wonderful thing that was happening to them. And I was young too. I was a few years older than them, maybe 23, 24. They were 18 or 19. And we had this wonderful, jolly trip, if you can use that word these days, all the way to Saigon. We still call it Saigon. Ho Chi Minh City, isn't it now? Yeah. And I reflected afterwards, I wonder what happened to those boys. They were so young, they were so keen, and I didn't quite shed a tear, but sort of, you know, when I still think of them because they're captured in that moment for me. They didn't ever grow old. And the war was very nearly at an end, of course, so hopefully things weren't too dreadful for them, and hopefully they kept some of that joie de vivre and that innocence when they came back. But our first concert was in Saigon, and they were all there, front row of the audience, and there were standing ovations all around, and it was like we were all at a big party. And of course that all changed over the next couple of weeks, as on one occasion we were 24 hours away from being bombed in a base, which was, you know, we left to go onto another concert and the base was obliterated. You know, things like that happened all the time. We travelled in helicopters, and I can't remember whether the doors were removed or just open, and a gunner would sit there with his machine gun trained on the ground, making sure nobody tried to shoot at us. And of course, Vietnam is all coastline, so you could see the warships and so on out in the water. And a lot of heavy gunfire, heavy artillery was happening between the coasts and those warships. And I don't think we were in any danger, but there were no chances being taken. And I always rather admired that chap, you know, hundreds of feet above the ground with his feet dangling out. But anyway, they took it all in their stride. So there was that first memory of those young boys. That was perhaps my most poignant memory. And the second one was, one day we were doing a concert. This was unusual. We were in some sort of building or enormous tent or something. Most unusual. Usually it was outside. We were under shade and the boys were just sitting out on the grass under a few trees, hopefully, because, gosh, it was hot. Oh, my. Adelaide's hot, but this was absolutely steamy. And right at the back of the audience, and there were, for some reason, there was an empty row of seats or something, and in came this he was an African American, a black man, and he had on an American uniform, and he sat all the way up the back by himself, and there was this terrible air of despair about him. And all down the front were all our boys, and we're all having a wonderful time, and this poor man sat all by himself at the back. And I had to reflect again on, I wonder what awaited those people when they went back to America. Was it the same as some of the things that awaited our guys? I don't know. So for me, there were some very interesting moments, but there were a lot of poignant moments too that really did give me cause for reflection. Mm-hmm. And I was so young and I'd never thought about war. You didn't in Australia. We had never had a war in my time. I had never known anyone who went away to war. I'd just missed the war, being born in 1946. And suddenly there it was in your face. And when I ultimately saw the extraordinary footage of that tank crashing through those big, high, wrought iron gates, I think they were of the palace in Saigon, and therefore that was the end of the war. The war had been lost by the Allies, if that's the right word, in the Vietnam War. And that was a poignant moment too. So it's a series of poignant moments. The other thing was I received, very, very fortunate to receive an AM last year, and the governor, when he awarded it to me, said, because he's Vietnamese, of course, in South Australia, splendid man, and he said to me, as he handed me the medal, "I see you're in Vietnam. What did you think about it? What was it that struck you?" And I said to him, "It was the people. These people have been invaded so many times presumably because of this wonderful coastline and very precious geographical location to many countries. And they've been invaded endlessly. They always seem to manage to bounce back. They're extraordinary people." And we all know that some of them went to re-education camps or some such, because I toured Vietnam with a girlfriend years later, and our drivers were a couple of Vietnamese people who talked about their grandfathers who'd had to have 6 months in these camps. But they'd come out smiling. They said, no, this is the way it is now. We're all fine, you know. Okay. Extraordinary people. They just bounce back. And I said to the governor that It was the people. It was these amazing people who must have been, every day they must have been terrified of what was going to happen. But they were still smiling and still gracious, and they were wonderful, wonderful people. And of course, life's always about the people, isn't it? It's not about anything else. It's about the people. We create our own existence. So my time in Vietnam was terrific. I thoroughly enjoyed everybody I met. And there were several people from Tasmania who happened to be in the army, and I happened to catch up with them. So that was all... It was a lot of fun, as well as being very touching and everything else. And there's nothing quite like singing to all those troops sitting out in the hot sun. It was so sweet of them to come. And we had a ball. We really did. The other thing that struck me was coming back to Australia. It was so... Oh, how do you say? It was just so peaceful. It was so wonderful to be home. It was just, here we are in this safe land, and there was never a suggestion. Don't forget, I'm going back to 1971, that anybody would try to invade us. As I say, they were such innocent times. But I do have a lovely postscript to my Vietnam time. There's a wonderful community club here called the Tanunda Club, and it's a place where you can go and, back in those days, you could go and dance, or you could go and have dinner, or you could just stand at the bar and have a drink. And I was at a sort of a dance, if you could put it that way, dinner dance thing, which one had back then, which really does age one. And somebody came over to me and said, I've just met up at a party in Sydney. It was a party in Sydney, one of the people who went to Vietnam with you. And it was Patty Urquhart, who was one of the singers. The other one was Diana Dalton. And Patty gave me, and I said I lived in Tanunda, and she said, oh, I think Patsy lives there now. So would you please give her my phone number? So that was fine. That was terrific. Managed to catch up with Patty later. But what then happened was, he went back to his seat with his friends, and I went back to my seat with my friends. And then the bandmaster or something said, ladies, it's your turn to take a partner. So I thought, oh, golly, what on earth am I going to do now? And I looked around the room and thought, well, because I was there with a whole party of girls. And there was Jack sitting on the other side, and I sort of raised a laconic eyebrow. Oh, do you want to dance? He said, we have to. And he sort of raised an eyebrow and went, oh, okay. And we danced, and we've been married quite a long time now. He had on the same jacket, was really the point, that had this phone number in it. And when he saw me, he said, oh, I think that's Pat. We'd never met, Patsy Biscoe. I must take this phone number over. And that was the end of Vietnam for me. My husband appeared. An all-round beautiful ending, I think.
That is a fantastic story. I didn't see that coming at all.
Well, Jack reminded me last night when I said you were coming. Yeah.
Can I ask you, can you have a think, how was the setup? Was it quite primitive, the production of what you were doing, or was it really kind of just up where we go, or was there a lot of preparation, or was it all, you know, fairly rushed? And
well, being the army, of course, it ran like clockwork. Logistically, it was very sound. We were given Terry, name, surname, I forget now, but he was a great guy, and he took us. He was our personal guide, and he was always with us. He smoothed out everything. I think the concerts were predominantly, and I may be incorrect in this, I think they were predominantly, they were certainly during the day, because you couldn't obviously light up a great stage. That would have been a way to attract attention, which wouldn't have been a good look in a war zone. So they were during the day. The stages were beautiful. They were big, high, lovely stages, because I think a lot of concert tours came through. We were a very small part of it. And there were huge tours like Bob Hope and people like that, and they would have. So they needed these massive stages. So we little Tasmanians would sort of group in the middle and just try and get up close and personal to the guys rather than trying to make it a big flashy show. And I think we succeeded by and large. I hope we did anyway. We felt we were. And the band was excellent and the sound systems were great. And we always, the reason I think it's the morning is I always recall having these endless Vietnamese banquets. They were fabulous. I've never eaten so much rice in my life. It was great. So we would do our concert, and then not everybody, but just a few of the invited people would come back and have lunch with us. And we met some splendid people, interesting people. And to a man, they really did put on, was it a brave face? I don't know what it was, but they were charming, they were erudite. They told us things we wanted to know. At one point, we expressed an interest in seeing through a little village. And they said, well, we're in a, because we went a long way north, almost to the border between north and south, effectively. And I remember this time they said, well, we can show you a village and we'll just take you in a camouflage truck, you know, open truck. And you'll have to get rid of all your jewellery and your ribbons and everything else. And we must just put you in uniform. Because if they think for 1 minute you're somebody important, they will either shoot you or they'll kidnap you or they'll do something, because we know that there's Viet Cong strongholds in all of these places. And we drove through this village and it was extraordinary. People just were sitting on their sort of tiny front porches, the way the Vietnamese do tend to love to be out amongst the people and on the footpath and whatever. It was just a dirt road or something. Tiny little, very simple homes, and people sitting outside. And I remember in particular, nobody waved or did anything like that. And one man who was quite old from memory just sat there and stared at us, and the look in his eye was, oh goodness, I do hope he doesn't have a gun handy, you know. It was a side that was riveting, absolutely riveting. You really felt you were getting to see some of the sorts of things that our frontline boys were seeing there. And that was not something I wanted repeated. So the next time they decided they would do that, I thought, no, I'm not going on that, because that was such sadness in his eyes and such hostility and such, what do I do now? My life, you know, as I know it, is, it may well be over tomorrow. So it's again, keep getting back to the fact it's all about the people and the terrible effect that wars have on people. The people who lived there as well, as, of course, as the soldiers.
Mm.
Dreadful. Just even after all these years, I can remember the expressions. I saw a caged lion once in a tiny zoo in New Zealand, and it was the same sort of look, this sort of splendid person, you know, going, what am I doing here? What is going on? Why is this happening? And I suppose if you've, it doesn't matter how many times you're subjected to war or to the possibility of being murdered or worse, I don't think it gets any easier.
Have you reflected on that a lot, that particular gentleman?
Yes. I think all the things that I've mentioned, the black man at the back of the concert all by himself looking so haunted and sad and distressed, those young boys who conversely look absolutely excited and thrilled to bits to be going off on this boy adventure, and then those Vietnamese who were really on the front line themselves, in a way, who had no idea what was happening next. The look on their faces, mixed with enormous hostility. Yes, they're things that they keep flashing back to me. And I'm very lucky that I was able to get on an aeroplane and come home, you know, to this marvellous place we live in, which I know sounds very trite, but it's true. This is a great place we live in. And by and large, we feel very safe here.
Just there, you mentioned about getting on a plane and coming back and returning to Australia. What sort of emotions were, if you can recall, what sort of emotions were you going through when you're on that journey coming back to Australia?
Oh, I remember absolutely distinctly, I cried the whole time. I didn't want to leave these people. I didn't want to leave this extraordinary situation without, because I didn't feel I'd done anything. I might have hopefully brought a bit of music to a few people, but I hadn't actually done anything, you know, and these people were left to do it all. Oh, I just cried. What else do you do? It was huge. And I can't imagine what some of the people to whom I know you've spoken, what they must have felt when they came back and everything they'd seen. I mean, mine was tip of the iceberg stuff. I saw the effect on people. I didn't see it actually happening to anybody. It was huge. And it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience that I would hope shaped me to be a more compassionate adult. I would hope.
Thinking back to the music that you were performing, can you recall some of the songs that were
absolutely
in the show?
We started off with, I can't remember the name of the band, What Goes Up Must Come Down, Spinning Wheel. So big rock and roll number, out we came. It was well out of my territory, but I managed to throw a few lines in here and there. That was great fun. And then I can't remember what other songs we did. I remember I'm doing some sort of, for me, it was more Julie Andrews sorts of songs. That's the sort of voice I've got, or Judith Durham sort of stuff. And not, of course, in Julie Andrews' league, do not misunderstand me, but, you know, that's that sort of... I started training as an opera singer, so I've got that sort of voice. And I sang Puff the Magic Dragon because I was singing children's songs, and so the broad brushstroke was we do one segment of these marvellous songs with this great Sullivan's Cove jazz stompers, you know, pull out all the stops, and there were trombones going, and it was just fabulous music and a bit of good singing of those sorts of mainstream songs, and then we would each come out and do our own segment, and I would come out with my guitar, just me and the guitar. Leaving on a jet plane, those sorts of things, and lots of and the boys were great. With lots of sing-alongy things like Kumbaya and, you know, all that stuff. So we just had a ball doing what each of us did, and each of us brought a different style to it. Patty was a bit of a comedian. Diana Dalton had a fantastic voice, so she could come and belt out some wonderful pop songs, and then I'd come out and do my little much quieter but more interactive sort of folk music. So I went back to folk from the children's music I was singing at that stage.
On returning to Australia, did you meet people who witnessed your performances?
Interestingly, only one, and it was last Christmas at the RSL in Tanunda when this wonderful chap sat next to me. So that's 2019 Christmas, and we had this marvellous chat. We had a ball for an hour and a half over the roast duck or whatever we were having. Splendid, splendid day. And he had some photos he'd taken from the audience, some of which I've shown you one that he gave, very kindly sent me. And apart from the fact, golly, I looked okay back then. He was great company, and he loved the concerts. He loved them. And he was a man who had, I think, been to hell and back out there reading Between the Lines, but we just had a great time, and we talked a lot about the light, as you said before, the lighter side of what it was all about, and about this comradeship. Again, these are slightly hackneyed words, I guess, but there was that feeling all the way through. So no, he's the only one who's ever said anything. And it was interesting that it was quite a long time before I was given a service number, or quite a long time before the Australians... certainly in my concert party, and I presume it applied to everybody, were recognised as having made a contribution and given medals and all of, and could wear them on Anzac Day. And very proudly, I wear those too. It's great. Well, I shouldn't exaggerate. It's one medal compared to all these people with splendid rows of them on their left breast. But, you know, my one medal's jolly good. Sits there with the AM medal, looking good on the right occasions.
How did you feel when you received notification that you were to receive them?
Delighted. And in a way, vindicated in that I felt I'd contributed in some tiny, tiny, tiny way. I mean, nothing like these boys did, but a tiny way. I should say women as well. I'm sure there were women there. But it did just make me think I was there. I was a part of this momentous event that certainly shaped me. And this is lovely to have some recognition of it. Made me feel part of a team.
This is fascinating because you've come into that world and alleviated some of the stress and some of the, I'm sure, the anxiety and trauma for all of the troops there. Like, in the presence of a concert and a performance, it must be a total release for the troops.
I was thinking about the type of music we played, particularly when the Sullivan's Cove Jazz Stompers were in full, gorgeous brass flight and guitars, and I think they even had a piano. How do you get a piano in Vietnam? I'm not sure, but something like that. It was wonderful. Can't remember now. And the music was big and bold and brassy in the literal sense, and so they did this wonderful song at the beginning. Then out we came, and I hadn't had any part in choosing the dresses, but they were definitely mini skirts, and all the boys quite liked that. So you'd get the catcalls and the whistles, and out we'd come and sing our spinning wheel as our opening song, which sort of went down magnificently. And I think that music like that, that is so joyful, and it's got to take you out of yourself. It has to, because it's big, thumping, bold music, you know, with hopefully some quite pretty girls popping around on the stage and so on, and an MC who comes out and cracks jokes in between and stuff. It was a good formula. I think people, for a few minutes, were able to get lost in it. It was great.
Can we step back a little bit further then and just talk about what preparation did you have with the musicians before you embarked?
Yes, went down to Hobart, got acquainted with the dresses that I didn't even know about, which were delightful, and short, very short, but delightful, and then went to, I think it was Rest Point, had a brief, splendid rehearsal with the band, and then did a floor show, I guess. So there were these people there. I don't know where they got the audience from or whether they just advertised it as a special event. They were having dinner. Then we all came out and really did our Vietnam concert for these people, but abbreviated. And it, again, standing ovations and things. It was fantastic. So there may have been army people there, I'm not sure. But that was the only rehearsal. And then suddenly there we were in Saigon and away we went and did it all again. So fortunately one remembered the words back then, which is the big thing.
It was fairly short and sharp.
Yes, I don't know whether they'd all been rehearsing together, but I certainly came in just once and then we were on our way. Time was a bit of essence, because when you're doing daily television shows, and I was pumping out about 20 hours of national television a week, so you can't really take time off.
Your time is precious.
Absolutely, yeah. And I was very pleased that Channel 9 continued to pay me while I went to Vietnam. That was unheard of back then. So they were very supportive. It's a long time ago and it was a beaut thing for them to do.
When you returned to Australia, did you find there was a lot of interest in what you'd experienced?
Not as much as you'd think. And there was certainly some... Is criticism too strong a word? I'm not sure. But why did you go there? We don't actually agree with that war. You know, these sorts of comments that were around back then. And of course, nobody agrees with war. Nobody wants war. But if you're in a position where you have to do something about a situation, then it has to happen. My response to that would be, well, I went to bring a little joy, as you would say, to alleviate some of the heaviness that was happening there, and we achieved that. And as far as I'm concerned, it was a terrific thing to do for the Aussies, and the audiences were Australian predominantly. So, no, it was great. People didn't seem terribly interested at all. Of course, my background had been folk music, and we took ourselves pretty seriously back then. We were there with the long hair and the black clothes and we thought that our opinion really mattered. For goodness sake, we were 22 or 23 or something. We didn't matter at all, but we thought we did. So these people they thought they were politically savvy about things. So they weren't going to pretend an interest. They were probably dying to know. But no, they stood back and just, tried to look a little superior about it all, I think.
How did you feel about people's reactions in general to Vietnam, and like for people back here in Australia, life just went on, life continued.
It's a bizarre thing, isn't it?
Very disconnected.
Yes.
How did that make you feel after you'd been to Vietnam and just seen a few things that you've shared with us?
Well, it's a very strange word, discombobulated, and that's how I felt. It sort of meant I was all at sea. It didn't make any sense that all of this was still going on over there, albeit it was in the final stages, but it was still going on. And here I was sitting here having Vegemite on toast and a cup of tea and thinking, oh, isn't this lovely? I'll watch a bit of morning television or something. It seemed surreal. It was very strange. And you finally, one morning, wake up and you're not consumed with thoughts of what's happening in Vietnam. And so then you're back into your normal life, But, no, for a few weeks it was quite odd. And I'm back on stage and singing to all these kids and things and saying, now, let's all moo like cows. And back in those days, even 12-year-old boys would moo like cows in shopping centres, which they certainly wouldn't be seen dead doing now. And you'd be doing this lighthearted stuff and leaping across the stage, going twinkle, twinkle, little star. And it was weird. It was really strange, because that was the whole point, isn't it? You come back to your own life. And I think that must be a really tricky thing for people who were there for longer than 17 days. That's a very hard ask.
Patsy Bisco, thank you so much for sharing a few stories and experiences with me today. I wish you all the best for the future It's been a privilege to meet you. Thank you so much.
I have enjoyed every minute of it, and may I congratulate you for taking on this project. It's really valuable, and I think everybody you've met, if they're as enchanted as I am, will be having a lovely time. So thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.